This is the So You Talk to Cows podcast, a podcast for agricultural communicators or really anyone interested in the ag industry or improving their communication skills. I'm Erica Earlbeck, a professor of agricultural communications at Texas Tech University and author of The Crisis Communications Guide for Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources. This season, I'm focusing our topics on risk and crisis communications. I have known this episode's guest for a long time through our membership in the Association for Communications Excellence, or ACE, and I'm always impressed by how prepared she is. Faith Peppers is the Director of Communications for USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture, but she has worked in a number of roles in her career, including many that require her to prepare for or communicate about a crisis. I'll let her tell you the details of her career. Faith, welcome, and let's start by you sharing your career history with us.
Sure. So I started my career at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and eventually moved into marketing for the newspaper. And that included major events that the newspaper sponsored, like the Peachtree Road Race, NASCAR races, different community events. And so I got a good taste of crisis communication, crisis preparedness when working with events like that through the newspaper business, but also reputation management for a major company. And after I left the newspaper, I went to work for a hospital system in Atlanta and in their communications department. And that was an interesting education and what goes on in that business when it comes to crisis communication. Of course, there was media relations that had to happen. I learned about HIPAA laws, and when celebrities are brought into a hospital, sometimes media follows and what the rules are. And it was a private hospital system, so I learned all about where media can and can't stand on private property. So that was very interesting. But one of the best things that we did there that really helped me prepare to become proficient in crisis communication was hospitals are required to do drills once a year if they are a critical care center. And so you never knew when it was going to happen. And sometimes it would take you a little while to realize it was a drill. They would actually hire actors who they would bring in great trauma. The one I remember when I was there was there was a bus crash, and they were bringing all the people in from this accident. And it's not to really drill your communications unit on how well they do in crisis communication, but really to drill your hospital on how well they can respond to a major emergency like that. But part of that was, as a communication unit, how did we handle that? How did we work with the media? How did we protect the privacy of the patients? And it was very interesting because actors can be very dramatic. And so when we had actual incidents happen, they were rarely as dramatic as the scheduled drills were. So that was terrific training. To understand the other side of what happens in a crisis. And then when I went to work at the University of Georgia, I spent several decades there working in various levels of issue management, crisis communication. And it was both internal within the organization, but also working with the communities that we served and helping them mitigate crisis and deal with crisis. And so I always say that working in a college of agriculture is the apex of crisis, because you mix underage students, if you have a 4-H program or other youth programs, then you have college students, you have employees, you quite often have animals involved. And so there's so many things that can go wrong in that situation. So there's so much that you have to be prepared for. We also had many facilities that were spread across the state. And Georgia is the largest landmass state east of the Mississippi. So it's about 300 miles long and 250 miles wide. It's a big state. So there could be 7 or 8 hours from one facility to another. So I learned how to train staff who were located near those facilities so that you could get immediate help to people who needed it while you were really coming in with a crisis plan and the spokespeople and others to help. So it was a great training ground.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I got cracked up at your, when you introduced yourself before your panel discussion at Ag Media Summit, you're like, oh, we had a couple hundred extension agents, all sorts of different research stations, hundreds of heads of animals, and several thousand 4-H members. What could go wrong?
There's a lot.
Yes, quite a bit. But I have, like, I've known you for quite a while now. And in the years that I've known you, I've heard you discuss some of the crises that you handled. And there's one time I remember at Lead 21, like, you were firing off statements, media statements to somebody because of something that happened at a 4-H camp or something like that. So tell me about some of the crises that really stick out in your memory and how you handled them.
Sure. So there are a lot of them, but I think when you look at what is an internal crisis and what is an external crisis, there's a big difference. And when you look internally, you have to look at what are those things that impact the people who care about your organization. And then externally, you have to look at what are the things happening here that could have an impact on the public. And so there are just so many things that can happen in the agriculture space. And one of the ones that comes to mind was an incident that we had at one of our education facilities, where it's a facility that has an endowment. So it's a named facility for a person who's still living. And we had a group there. They were not a part of our organization, but they had rented the facility for an educational experience. And some kids had wandered into, well, they were out doing some beach combing, and there was a rough tide. And they weren't hurt, but it scared them. And so it took us a little while to figure out, you know, exactly what the medical situation was. And then, is this situation going to get media coverage? And of course, the students were from the same town as the donor. So if it only showed up in their local newspaper, it would be the donor's local newspaper whose name was on the facility. So first, we had to take care of the incident, make sure everybody was safe and sound and unharmed. And so I had a facilities manager there that I had to walk through, you know, make sure you're taking care of all these steps. Now you take care of that and let me take care of this. So we had talking points ready for people. And we had a lot of these in the can, right? Because you think about what are all the things that could happen?
Mm-hmm.
How prepared can I be? You can't think of every single scenario, but you can think of large situations where you can have standard talking points that you can then fit to the situation at hand. But this was the first time that I had to deal with one that also involved a donor. So we had to make sure that the person who is in charge of our development office contacted the donor personally and explained what the situation was. Because if they talked about the facility in the media, they would be using their name.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very important for us to make sure that they understood exactly what the situation was from us.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, you know, there's a possibility this could end up in the news. It didn't, but it was a great drill to walk through all those steps to find out exactly what all the considerations are. And, you know, I've always thought of it from the other end. In crisis training, they tell you if you're going over a cliff, don't take your supporters with you. And so I had never thought about, well, we're not, but what is our obligation to those supporters and letting them know what has happened here? So that added a whole new dimension to our planning and to our crisis communication plan. So when we knew we had named facilities or people who were publicly identified with a facility or a program, that we always included that personal contact with them as a part of our crisis plan.
That's so good. Yeah. Like, who would be upset if you did not call them?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And the person with their name on the front gate is probably the first person. and then, you know, in serving the community, there are things we do that we don't think of as crisis communication that have a huge impact on the people that we serve in our states. And I remember we did a story about how to respond to a snake bite, just as a kind of standard extension wildlife story.
Yeah.
And within a couple of weeks, we got a letter from a man who said that he read that story in his local paper. And he thought it was interesting. It was new information. It was things he had not heard before about how to react if you're bitten by a venomous snake. And he said, sure enough, about a week later, he was coming in from his field and got bitten by a rattlesnake. And he said, for some reason, his mind immediately went back to that story, because your instinct is to run and get away. But the story said, don't run, because that increases your blood flow. And so he just got, I think he said he got up on his truck and called his son, who was ahead of him, and said, you know, come back, I've been bitten by a snake. And he immediately took him to the doctor. And he said that at the hospital, they said, you did all the right things. And he said, I only did that because I had just read that story and it was so fresh in my mind. So that was a good reminder to us that the information that we provide people can have real life-saving power. And so sometimes we're mitigating crisis when we don't even know it. And then there are times that we do know it. I got a call from our weed specialist, and he came in to brief the dean and me about a new pest that they were seeing. And he said, it's a matter of time until it shows up in Georgia, and we need to be prepared, because it was particularly bad in cotton and peanuts. And that's two of our big, was our biggest crops in Georgia. And it was called polymer amaranth, or pigweed.
Mm-hmm.
So he was explaining to us what an invasive weed this was. And sure enough, I mean, it spread across the U.S. so fast. And then sometimes the remedy is worse than the pest. And they, you know, started looking for what were solutions. And they, you know, were trying different chemical solutions, different plant breeds that would be able to sustain it. And that caused a whole nother realm of problems. So to address that situation, he worked very closely with the Department of Agriculture and developed a training that they went to as many communities as they could go to, and just explained, you know, what the situation is. How can you mitigate the invasive pest? If you choose to use these chemicals, what the safety measures are that you need? And every state is different. And if you look at some states, like in the Midwest, they may have corn for miles and miles and miles. But in a state like Georgia that has so many different crops and much smaller farms, it's more like a patchwork. And what could be good for this patch over here could be detrimental to this patch over here. And mm-hmm. So how do you walk that fine line and preserve your crops while protecting your neighbors? And they did a wonderful job with that training. And I think we were one of the few states that had no or very few complaints about oversprays of chemicals that were killing other crops. And it was because they took the time to really educate people about the situation, how to deal with it up front before it became a major problem. And it was a major problem in some states. I mean, there were people who, like, got into fights with their neighbors over it. So that was a good experience for us to be able to show the power of education.
And yes, it's funny because like on the pigweed thing, like I often joke, like that's the only thing that's growing outside of our building right now because it's so hot. So yeah, it made it everywhere.
Yes, and it's tough to kill. It is tough to kill.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, it sounds like, I don't know, either that person, you know, just going off of that pigweed example, either that person was just really astute and kind of thought ahead, or maybe you had them trained to let you know about some developing crises. But how do you go about preparing for these things?
Well, I think, you know, it really has to be a two-pronged approach. You have to have a strong system of issues management, because if you can catch things while they're still an issue, you can't always prevent them from becoming a crisis, mm-hmm. but you can speed up your response to the crisis, and you can often minimize the impact of the crisis if you start educating yourself and you start working with others on it while it's still an issue. So when he first raised the fact that pigweed was going to be a major issue, we started managing it as an issue. And he is a particularly astute scientist, but he's also very media savvy. So he was great at spotting things that were going to become a big problem. And then how to make sure that all the people who needed to know were well briefed and constantly well briefed on what that situation is and how it's evolving. And that really became a great case study and an example for us to convince other scientists that this is a really important part of our organization that we need you to participate in. Sometimes scientists like to get in the lab and are like, just please don't talk to me. And so this was a great way to show the value and how you can not only mitigate a major problem for the people that we serve, but you can also create greater efficiencies in the work you're doing. So if you are responding to an issue and keeping it contained as an issue, or mitigating it as an issue and not letting it become a crisis, because crises are really expensive. It costs a lot, not only in resources and money to address, but it also damages your reputation and it soaks up your time. And then there's all the recovery that you have to go through on the other end. And so it's really expensive when it becomes a crisis. It's much better if you can manage it as an issue.
And sometimes you have to spend the money to manage the issue, but
yes.
It's almost always cheaper to manage the issue than the crisis. Yeah.
Yes. And if you're managing it as an issue, more often than not, you're seen as the helper who's there to help and to prevent things from happening. If you're the crisis manager, you're on the hot seat.
Yeah. That's a good way to think of that. So you'd mentioned, you know, managing reputations. What are some things that you currently do with your current employer or did with the University of Georgia that helped build that reputation with the target audience?
Well, I think one of the most important things you can do is to meet a crisis head on so that people always see you as trustworthy and believable. You only have one reputation, and rebuilding a reputation is almost impossible. You can often redeem yourself, but there's always that shadow of doubt once there's been a major crisis. I mean, do people ever think of BP the same way again as they did before the Horizon oil spill? You know, there's certain things that are attached to certain brands that even years later, people still think about in the back of their mind. And I know there many times I will buy a bottle of Tylenol and I'll check the seal before I open it. And how long ago was the issue with Tylenol? You know, there's certain things that become, because of the severity of the crisis, they become almost their own descriptor. When you want to talk about how bad something is, you talk about the Exxon Valdez, right? So what you don't want to be somebody's measure for badness. And so you protecting that reputation is so paramount. And one of the most important things you can do to protect your reputation is to show everything you did on the front end to ensure that that wouldn't happen. People understand that things are going to happen. There are things that you can't prevent. But if you can show that you have a strong track record of doing all the right things, they are far more forgiving when a wrong thing happens, especially if it was not of your own doing.
Good.
I think in reputation management, one of the key elements is that you have to have friends before a crisis happens, especially in the media. Because when you're in the throes of a crisis, nobody wants to be your friend. So you have to have those relationships. You have to have that trust. And you have to have that support before a crisis happens. So when the crisis does happen, you're not starting from zero. You're starting from this point of trust. And they're more likely to listen to you and be understanding of how this crisis happened if they have known you to always be ethical and upfront and past.
Talk about some things that you did to build those relationships with the media.
Well, you know, working in an organization that's present in every county in the state, and Georgia has a lot of them, 159 to be exact, it's important to build those media contacts because all news is local. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people overlook the value of a community newspaper. People buy community newspapers because it's their legal organ, because they know the reporters there, and because it's the news that they really care about. So they are more likely to read it, for one thing. And so I spent a lot of time working with community newspapers, attending press association meetings, making sure when I was in a community, I stopped by and visited with the newspaper editor. I made sure that I knew their names and they knew mine. And we provided them with news products every single week that they could rely on. And they knew that they could trust our content, which made them by proxy trust us as an organization. I would also do things like if our leadership was visiting in a community, can we stop by and visit with the local newspaper or radio or local TV station and do an interview while we're there and talk about what we're doing in your community. So always be a service to them so that when you need them, they're more likely to help you. And some of our biggest issues that did make it into the major media started with a story in the local newspaper. And so having that relationship, so they would at least warn me it was coming. And sometimes they would check the facts, you know, is this accurate? Because if it's going to get out there, it's hard to clean up something that's inaccurate. It's so much better if it goes out accurate in the first place. And to have that level of trust where they could ask me to verify facts for them without feeling threatened that I would try to stop them from doing their story. It was extremely valuable. And it's interesting because I've been away from my position there now for more than 3 years, and I still have those friendships with those editors. It's so important. And sometimes they would let me know about things that were going on in the community that they weren't sure I was aware of and that I might need to know about. So it was a two-way conversation. And that's very important too, that they know you listen to them. We would also do things like provide training for local media folks and in key topics that were hot topics. Like we had a major salmonella outbreak in Georgia involving peanuts a few years ago. And we did a training for people all over the state who were covering this story, but may not have expertise in covering a food safety issue. And we had the Center for Food Safety that was located pretty much in the center of the state. And it's internationally known as a center of excellence in food safety. And so we brought reporters in there and had the head of that center, who was in media all the time. but he came in and did a training on, if you have questions about this, you go to the CDC. If you have questions about this, you go to Department of Agriculture. If you're looking for background and expertise, please come to us. So we mapped out for them what were the clear paths to cover this crisis, to make sure that they were getting to the information they needed in the most direct path. So we also brought in communication people from the CDC, from the Department of Ag, from other organizations that they would need to talk with to be able to accurately cover that story. And so we always tried to be of service to them in ways like that, that was going to benefit them and help them cover these big stories. But that would also help build that relationship, not only with our communications team and with our organization, but also with our individual scientists.
Good, good. Yeah, that has to come in so helpful when, yeah. And you had said something, there's a saying out there, the falsehoods fly like a wildfire and the truth comes limping behind or something like that. Yeah, and you just hope that somebody will call you for a fact check. And if they know you, then yeah, you'll be able to get somewhat ahead of it. So
I got a heads up one time from a TV station in Atlanta. And it was one of those weird connections. The reporter that had been assigned to cover the story, I knew when she was a college student. I had met her, and it was like she had to interview somebody who had an interesting career in communication that was outside of what you would, you know, think of normally. And so she called me and came over and did an interview on me. And she ended up at one of the TV stations in Atlanta. And she called me one day and said, I'm fixing to make your day go south, but I felt like I should at least warn you that this is coming. And she said, I can only give you a 10-minute heads up, but we're about to have a story come out at 5 o'clock. She told me what it was, and she said, do what you can do in 10 minutes to get ahead of it. But just that 10-minute heads up allowed me to figure out the situation, to figure out why we were connected to the situation, and then prepare our spokespeople in case somebody called us, what do we say? But also to prepare myself. So if media call me, I could say, this person hasn't worked for us in 30 years. I don't know why you're calling us, right? And be able to at least try to push it off of us a little bit and get them to stop talking about us. Because this was somebody who had got into some trouble, but he had been away from the university for more than 30 years. So why are you identifying him as a former employee? I mean, there are a lot of people in nursing homes who are former employees. Why are you making this connection? But they were making the connection because a week before, they had been invited to an award ceremony where this man was given an award.
Okay.
So they were making this connection. So that made us go back and put a different step in and say, we need to vet people that we're giving awards to.
Yeah.
And make sure that they're really people that we want to be honoring in the name of our institution.
Yes. Yes.
So I think some of these stories have really brought out that when you go through the situation, on the backside, you can always strengthen your plan for the future. But there's always going to be something that you can never plan for. You know, how could I ever have seen that coming? But now I know it can, so now I'm going to put it in the plan. I think by the time I left, my crisis communication plan was about 65 pages long because there were a lot of scenarios in there.
Uh-huh. That's a pretty robust plan.
It was pretty robust. The piece that people really had to have and know was one page. The rest of it was reference. And for my my folks who were actually on the ground, I would make them like a business card size laminated card that had the three steps, the first three steps they should do to respond to a crisis. And then on the back, we would put the phone numbers of the people that they needed to call if they found themselves in a crisis situation. And the young faculty would always say, well, I have their number stored in my cell phone. Well, of course you do. And the one time you need it, your phone is going to be in the car, your battery is going to be dead, you don't have any cell service, and you don't know the phone number because you always just tell Siri to call them. So, you know, it's really important that you always keep this card in your wallet. And they laughed. They thought it was so funny until they needed it. And I can't tell you how many times I had people call me and say, you're absolutely right. I could not remember the phone number because I was in such a state and my phone battery was dead.
And so of course it was.
Yeah, I couldn't call from somebody else's phone. And then I was like, I have that card in my wallet. So sometimes, you know, you have to build in these backup contingencies for people who are so reliant on technology.
Oh, that is brilliant. And one of many brilliant ideas you have shared with us today. Thank you so much, Faith, for being my guest. I could talk to you for several more hours, but we do have a time limit. And thank you for listening. So You Talk to Cows is produced by me, Erica Erlbeck, with production support from the Department of Agricultural Education and Communications at Texas Tech University. For more information in creating and responding to a crisis, please check out my new book, The Crisis Communications Guide for Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources, available now from Xanadu Publishing. That's Xanedu, and the link is in the show notes.